Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and the 1994 game from Microsoft Home, the point-and-click game called The Magic School Bus Explores the Human Body, a fun-filled fact-packed science adventure, taught me more about the human body than my private Christian school education ever did.
Hi, I'm Violet. My pronouns are she, her. I have ADHD. And if I had to pick a favorite dress-up game, like a video game about dressing up and cool outfits and things, I'd probably say Elden Ring. You probably played a lot of games growing up, I think. Knowing what I know about you, I think you played more games than most people, I would say, or like most young girls.
Yes and no. I've never been someone who's been able to just really play video games regularly. I don't know what it is, but my brain is like, but you're not actually doing anything. And then I get like, I don't know if it's my ADHD externalized hyperactivity is like, I have to go fucking do something. And then I would go do some absolute like unhinged child shit and go hit a rock in the backyard with a hammer.
Yeah, my childhood experience was pretty different. My parents were very limited in what they allowed me to do outside a lot of the time. My dad in particular, I used to think of him as very paranoid, a little, I would call him that less nowadays, but I was kind of stuck inside a lot as a kid, and that meant me and my two brothers had a chance to get into video games. At the time, my family thought I was a boy, and I turned out to not be a boy, which is great. But
if you look at any childhood pictures of Violet, you can clearly say, oh, that kid is a girl.
Yeah, honestly, it is, yeah. Like, in hindsight, it's pretty clear.
If you look at the family pictures, you go, which one of these children is a trans girl? You're like, oh, it's that little one. It's that diva right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And ironically, the whole time I thought I was, like, really nailing the whole, like, masculinity thing because I was trying so hard to perform it. But I did grow up on a lot of video games. And I've played video games pretty much my whole life. My very first video game I ever played was Super Mario World for the Super Nintendo. And I even went back and played some older games after that, like the original.
I think mine was also Super Mario World.
It was a lot of people's first game, honestly. It was one of those games that was so good and popular.
That or Duck Hunt. I have vivid memories of playing Duck Hunt.
Yeah, absolutely. I know my dad got my mom a Super Nintendo with Super Mario World for her birthday, and it was supposed to be a present for her. And my mom was like, this is neat. It's all right. But obviously, me and my brothers were kind of obsessed after that point. And we were playing things like the original Sword and Sorcery games and Heroes of Might and Magic. We were getting to Red Alert, Command and Conquer, all this stuff. But what I didn't really get into at the time, and what I wish I would have gotten more into, was girl games. And that's what today's episode is about, is girl games.
So I don't know how many of these I actually played. I was a big fan of a lot of straight up just educational computer games. The Magic School Bus thing is not even really a joke. I had all of the Magic School Bus games.
Oh yeah.
There was like a geology one I really, really got into. My first console that I ever actually remember getting that was intended for me, though, was the Nintendo 64. And the three games they got me when I got my Nintendo 64 were GoldenEye, Mario Kart, and Star Fox.
Heck yeah. Absolutely. Absolute classic games all around. And
yep.
When it comes to girl games, there's a reason, right, why a lot of the games that you ended up playing and enjoying most were not necessarily girl games. They were just educational games, games targeted at a younger audience, that sort of thing.
Autism.
Well, there's that, but also there's more of an industry, like games industry reason that I'm going to get into here in a bit.
Oh, interesting.
I should first preface all of this by saying a lot of the terminology and concepts I'm going to be talking about today are based very heavily in the gender binary. You know, the whole division between boy games, girl games, whatever. All of this is based on gender. It's a construct. It's
cishet normative binary standards that the developers decided to label games with somewhat arbitrarily based on some of the characteristics of the game.
Exactly. So I just want to preface by saying that there's going to be a lot of language and a lot of stereotypes talked about. So just a bit of a heads up there if that's something that might be triggering for you to be aware of. What's a girl game? A girl game in this context is defined by a game where the target audience of the game was intended to be primarily women in some capacity. Young women, older women, women in general, it's any of that. Those are what we would categorize as a girl game. That is, it's a pretty broad category nowadays, I would say. But originally, there wasn't a whole lot of games for girls. And when video games first came around, back in the early 70s and 80s, when they really started to gain some more notoriety with things like Pac-Man and Pong and Galaga and Centipede, that is really where, you know, mainstream appeal found games, or rather, games found mainstream appeal. And of course, whenever something finds mainstream appeal, that is going to a segment of the population that's female, just by its nature. But there was like very little to no representation in games for women. But when we talk about women who play games, there are actually a lot of statistics that are taken about who plays games. And in North America, we have the ESA, the Entertainment Software Association, and they've been around since 1997, cataloging and surveying people who play games and consume media to produce reports. And every year or so, they will release a document that they call the Essential Facts Booklet, talking about all of the essential facts and statistics surrounding video game playing. We actually just had the one for 2025 released on the 30th of last month, so very, very recently. So I've got some really up-to-date data on this, which is really cool. Looking back in history a little bit, in 2012, 47% of gamers were female. Looking back quite a bit further, there was a Nintendo study done back when the Super Nintendo first came out, and that showed roughly 27%, according to their survey. It was a more global survey, but
That seems very low still.
Oh yeah, that's going back in time a little bit. And then some of the first surveys that were done on the topic initially back in the Pac-Man era showed that in arcades, 7% roughly of the attendees were women. But that quickly, over the course of the next decade, would blow up to roughly 50% most of the time. Nowadays, 47% of gamers are female. And we define gamer as anyone who plays more than an hour a week of games.
So I would not be a gamer, I don't think, because I very rarely play games.
You're a gamer in my eyes. That's okay. I tell you a lot about games, and you're kind of experiencing them vicariously.
I listen to you talk about games for at least an hour every week, so that counts.
Yeah, you've got secondhand gamer.
So I actually looked up, because I was like, I had a horse game I really liked that I knew would have been counted as a girl game. It wasn't the Barbie one, because I became very anti-Barbie after watching something on TV talking about how she was an unrealistic expectation for little girls and explaining how she couldn't even stand upright with her proportions. I was 6 when I saw this. Then my mother found me putting all of the Barbies I had been given into the trash, which I didn't really care for them anyway. I was playing with my Power Rangers action figures and playing house with those instead. And then she's like, why are you getting rid of these? And I said, it's an unrealistic expectation for me. You shouldn't have let me have these. So then she kept them in the closet for when I changed my mind. And I found them in the closet because I was snooping. And then I said, what are these doing in my house? Which is a thing that my family would repeat until I got older and say, what are these doing in my house? So she got rid of my Barbies. So all that to say, I wasn't playing the Barbie horse riding games, but I found it. They're called the Let's Ride franchise.
Oh, gotcha. So I did look up some information about the Saddle Club video games. And the most popular one, because you had mentioned that.
Yeah, I had a friend who had the Saddle Club video games. Love those. Those were a bit older.
Gotcha.
This Let's Ride, they were available on PC, because I didn't have a console, like a PlayStation at all. And then later they were available like on PlayStation and Game Boy. But I played some of the earliest ones, like Let's Ride, the Rosemont Hill Collection. Here's your chance to own a stable full of horses. Care for each of your thoroughbreds, grooming and feeding them. So heck, it was different types of riding because I did equestrian sports and competitions and stuff for Western stuff. So it was just fun. I could be like, all right, back from a day of mucking stalls at the barn, I want to crack open a cold Coke and play my horse game at home.
And muck some virtual stables.
Yes.
So, yeah, absolutely. That's a great like kind of starting point in a lot of this, and talking about like the interests that were prevalent of the time. Like, what did girls want to play? There was, some of the biggest franchises in the horse gaming industry. You've probably heard of Star Stables.
Oh.
Yeah, Star Stables is a more modern entry. And there is a very, very, very popular horse game that you may have heard of, Red Dead Redemption 2.
Okay, but that's not the type of horse game I was interested in.
That's totally fair. But I will absolutely dig my heels in to anyone who says otherwise. It is Red Dead Redemption 2 is a horse game. You can absolutely do so many of the same things that you would do in any other horse game in Red Dead Redemption 2. There's just also beards and guns. And like, that's...
Oh, damn. If this Star Stable game would have been around when I was 9 years old,
you would have gone nuts.
I'm just looking like, look at that. A Belgian draft horse. Oh, look at that Palomino, that Appaloosa. Look at them all. Like, I'm already like, oh, horses.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that game is still around. If you did want to play it, I can make that happen.
I don't know. Maybe.
When we talk about girl games, I also want to make a delineation. We're not talking about necessarily games with a female protagonist like Ms. Pac-Man. The idea behind Ms. Pac-Man.
That's the gender neutral behind... the non-binary.
Ms. Pac-Man. The idea behind Ms. Pac-Man was they wanted to add some additional features to the game and also kind of address some of the concerns that people had, saying, oh, it's sexist that it's Pac-Man, but there's no Pac-Woman, right? And Ms. Pac-Man arguably was more successful than the original Pac-Man because it was a better game. Remember that. That's going to be a key point, right? The concept of games being good, and like good games are good games regardless of the content. That's an important part in this whole story that we're going to go on. So let's look at 2024. What were the top grossing games in the US? What made the most money? Well, looking at console and PC games, we see Call of Duty Black Ops 6, EA Sports College Football 25, Helldivers 2, I'm a big fan of that one, NBA 2025, Dragon Ball Sparking Zero, another Call of Duty, Elden Ring. These are, you know, you've probably heard of some or all of these. I'm not a big sports game person, but I don't want to get anybody's yum. Yeah, Call of Duty Shooter Man. Which, by the way, there's actually a significant portion of the Call of Duty fan base that is female. Historically, there's always been a large number of players that are female.
One of my favorite ASM artists, Skeptical Pickle, she started out as a Call of Duty streamer and not an ASM artist. So I learned this because occasionally she would get comments like, when are you going to stream Call of Duty again? And she's just like, when they make one that's actually new and fun.
When it comes to Call of Duty, there was actually some research done in terms of women in games where voice chat is common. And I believe the survey said something in the range of 67% of women who have played games online have either chosen not to use voice chat or have obscured their voice in some way to avoid being targeted by sexism in the game, which is why there's a huge portion of people that play Call of Duty that are female, but you may not know it if you didn't look that up. When it comes to a few more statistics that may be surprising, when I looked this up, 9% of gamers are people that identify as LGBTQIA in some way, shape, or form. And there's another 1% on top of that that identify as either they didn't specify a gender at all or are considered non-binary.
Cool.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, when we talk about generations, so the most recent generation, Gen Alpha, which is people between the ages of 5 and 12 right now, they are 83% gamers right now. 83% of Gen Alpha is
a
gamer.
Hey, you know what? With Roblox yeah. alone?
Roblox goes crazy. There's so much to Roblox.
If I want to talk to a kid of a certain age and be like, hey man, what's your thing on Roblox? And they're just like, ah! And like... automatic conversation starter.
Yeah, absolutely. Gen Z, we're looking at 78% gamers. Millennials, we're looking at 68% gamers.
Ah, we're so close to glory.
We're so close to glory. Gen X is 52% gamers. Oh, and I should say, the statistic for millennials, if we're like averaging it out, I think it is 69% male and then like 67% female. So there's a 69 in there. But Gen X is 52%.
For boys.
Blah. Boomers. This is the one that surprised me, because I feel like boomers are really people that's 61 to 79 years old. These are people that did not grow up with games. I was really surprised to find that 49% of boomers play more than 1 hour of games per week nowadays.
Candy Crush.
Candy, exactly. Yes, Candy Crush.
Just thinking about my mom. My mom would down. My mom, back when I talked to her, would download any game that would fuck up her iPad irreparably.
Oh yeah.
That was any kind of match game.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Any word game. Yeah.
My parents play every slots simulator imaginable. And that's blackjack, like, poker, bridge.
They don't look at the fact that the game is like, I need access to all of these things in your phone.
Right. Unfortunately. But even more surprising, though, the silent generation, people that are right now 80 to 90 years old, 36% gamers.
I believe it, though. I believe it with mobile games, especially, though.
Yeah, absolutely. A big part of the, as you go through the spread of things, mobile games are generally across the board more accessible to people that have not played games for as long. In 2025, anyone considered a gamer, the average length of time that they have been playing games is 18 years. And that's a huge portion of the base. The people that don't necessarily fall into that long-term gamer category all tend towards mobile games because it's so much more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, like, for a while. So I have a thing with games where I'll reach a certain thing where it's like, I want to accomplish this thing. And then once I've accomplished it, I get no dopamine from the game anymore and I never want to play it again.
That's me with movies a lot of the time.
So, yeah, that's me with video games. So there was the Marvel Future Fight mobile game. Where my favorite superhero is Squirrel Girl. And depending on how much you geared up and ranked and like advanced each one of your characters, there was like a global ranking system. So I just wanted to have the number one Squirrel Girl in the entire game.
Oh, yeah.
And then I did that. And then I never played it again.
I completely understand. A very brief detour. There's a game called Clash of Clans. I'm sure you've heard of it. And it was a game where, when you weren't playing, other people could like attack your base, and while you're playing, you build up your base, and in a nutshell, basically. And this person, for like several weeks straight, never stopped playing the game while he was awake. Like, he had iPads
Jesus
strategically
Christ.
Placed around the house. Yeah. And the goal was to become the number one player for an extended period of time. And he maintained this streak by always being logged into the game for several weeks, I think. And then afterwards, never played the game again. Just quit. Said, all right, I'm done. So
yeah, I get that.
Absolutely. It's a thing. One other little fun fact before I get more into girl games specifically. Just in March of this year, the ESA, they do these statistics. They released a website called accessiblegames.com where you can look at some new systems that they're trying to implement for tagging games for accessibility features, which I think is
really
very
cool.
Yeah. And it'll basically put a tag on a game wherever it's being sold that says, hey, this game has this accessibility feature, for example. Like, it has resizable text, which, by the way, that's the number one most requested accessibility accommodation for games, is the ability to change text size, which I think is, that makes a lot of sense. When we talk about girl games, so much of the early video game history was dominated by men and boys. The prevailing theory behind all of this was based in supposed market research and things like that, that showed that, oh, computers were a boy interest, despite the fact that since the dawn of computing, women have had a key role in how all of that worked. And similarly to the development of the internet and video games as well, they've always been involved. This supposed market research, sexism, said that women were simply not the target audience.
And it's funny because the thing that probably happened is they only went to go ask men.
Oh, probably, yeah. the market research they probably did predominantly was like,
let's go to the Elks Lodge men. And ask people about video games.
Exactly. Yeah. This, I think, was really highlighted as a problem in 1983. A Coleco executive, if you're familiar with the ColecoVision game console, they were at a convention for the Boston Computer Society. And at that convention, they were doing a talk about their upcoming at-home computer console with gaming features and things like that, because this is a game console company making a home computer for gaming, essentially called the Atom. And that Atom home computer, they said their primary target audience was young men and boys. And when he said that in this 1983 conference, he was booed by the audience.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Absolutely. When that happened, they quickly like scrambled and said that, you know, the commercial that we were making is targeting men and young boys because that is, according to market research, the demographic we need to focus on. And they also in the talk said, oh, and we also have a commercial for girls too, which I could not find any proof that they ever made a commercial for the Atom PC that was marketed to girls. I think they just said that in the conference to
please
not
stop
get booed
booing
off stage.
Please
exactly
stop booing.
Right. Please clap. when the audience members booed, they basically just scrambled and said, hey, it's based off consumer research. That was kind of it. They quickly changed topics and started talking about other things. But I feel like this really was one of the first times where it was very publicly clear and people understood that games were not just for men and boys. This was already at a point where arcades were at least 7% filled with women playing games. And it was well understood that women played games too. So that very same year, 1983, one of the first video games to ever be targeted at women was released. And this was Strawberry Shortcake Musical Matchups.
Oh, that's cute.
Yes. Now, interestingly enough, if you were to Google what was the first game ever targeted for women, you would probably get some information on a game called Jenny of the Prairie. But that actually came out, I believe, the year after, in 1984. But Strawberry Shortcake is very clearly targeted at young girls. And
yeah,
I would say that Strawberry Shortcake Musical Matchups, it's a, like a puzzle game, basically, where there's a villain called the Purple Pie Man, and he came in and basically scrambled everyone up, and you've got to like match people's like torsos and their legs and their head together in
oh,
the right
fun,
order
yeah,
to like fix, get everybody put back together. That was basically the first game. And then the next year, the reason I think that Jenny of the Prairie is touted as the first game targeted at girls is because it was made by a company whose tagline was computer games for girls. This was a company called Rhiannon Software. Their whole shtick was, we make computer games specifically for girls. Jenny of the Prairie, and then there was another game that came out roughly at the same time called Chelsea of the South Sea Islands. These were basically survival games, which was interesting.
I'm looking up Jenny yeah of the Prairie. In the yeah description, Jenny was left behind by her family, lost in the prairie.
In the prairie. Yep.
The prairie needs to keep her safe, fed, and watered as she prepares herself for the coming winter. Jesus Christ. She may also attempt to tame a fox.
Yeah. She can chop wood for a fire, pick flowers, pick wheat, and hunt rabbits for food and fur to keep warm. She may also attempt to tame a fox. She needs to avoid the mountain lion and the rattlesnake. If they get to Jenny, it's game over. And in Chelsea of the South Sea Islands, she's a young British girl who's become marooned on a small island in the South Pacific with her pet kiwi. The player starts on a small jungle crossroads and must survive off the land over 9 screens until her family returns for her. Armed with a machete, Chelsea must scavenge for food and a balanced diet, or ensuring a balanced diet. She must also ensure she drinks water regularly and needs to find wood to start a small fire to keep herself warm at night. Like, I get it. These are, I feel like they just took a survival game and slapped a young girl protagonist on it and said it's a game for girls.
So interesting. I was looking up, because I'm like, was this inspired by that novel Hatchet? Do you know that novel?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hatchet was 1987, because I knew it was like in that neighborhood, but it was a couple years after these. But like, children's survival stuff was just like a theme.
Swiss Family Robinson.
But that's even older. I just don't know. I guess maybe the trend recurred.
But I think this was all before any market research had been done as to what games girls would want to play.
It's just so odd because Swiss Family Robinson was like 1950 something, 60 something.
True.
And they're like, yeah, kids like this. It's 20 years later. What do I know? Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say why they made those. Yeah. Looking into the future a little bit, there is some better games, I think, that get made. So in the early days, right, where we still are, we have a lot of the what we would call girl games at this point are still kind of intertwined with the toy industry. We have, are you familiar with the term Game & Watch?
No.
Yeah, so in the early 80s, Nintendo released a line of these things called Game & Watch. And the idea behind a Game & Watch is it's like a little handheld, it's a single game in a handheld format on a segmented liquid crystal display, kind of like a watch. You could play a game on this, and it also had a clock with an alarm function built in. There were a lot of games made at this time in Japan, especially, that were in this kind of Game & Watch format that were targeted for girls. In particular, there was a game called, in Japan, Aishite Night Herpet, which roughly translates to Love Me, My Night Herpet. It's a, like a simple matchmaking game, basically.
What is a herpet?
I do not entirely know. I think it's kind of a proper name for a type of fortune-telling game. I wasn't able to find a clear definition, but there's a game just called Herpet, and this is a fortune-telling game, basically, that was in a similar format. So there's also Sailor Moon Herpet, and there was also, in the U.S., a Polly Pocket Game & Watch style game.
Oh, fuck. Did I have that?
You might have.
I
it
might
was
have
pretty
had
popular.
The Polly. I liked Polly Pocket.
Absolutely, yeah. You very well might have had that. So these were back in the mid-80s when these were coming out. Once we start getting into the era where consoles were a thing, so we had the Commodore 64, ColecoVision, all this. In 1984, we had one of the first mainstream video game releases aimed at women with Barbie for the Commodore 64. It's the Barbie's first ever video game on the Commodore 64. It was not very good. We also, a little while later, we had Barbie for the Nintendo Entertainment System. This is in 1992, but that's skipping ahead a little bit. So are you familiar with a little arcade game called Centipede?
Yes. So you know what? My first gaming console wasn't actually the Nintendo 64. I actually had a Game Boy Pocket.
Oh, yeah.
And Centipede was one of the games in my Game Boy Pocket. I got Centipede and I got Donkey Kong.
Interestingly enough about Centipede, Centipede was a game made by one person. It was made by a woman at Atari named Donna Bailey. She, from what I understand, made the game entirely herself, and it was sold by Atari, and it's like reputed as one of the greatest like early games of all time, you know. It's up there. It's one of those, like, you think of arcade games, Centipede is one of those classic arcade games that was one of the original ones. And she is very rarely talked about in video game history, despite, like, this, I think this released in the same, it was 2 years before Coleco would go on to say, we're not targeting women for games. We're just... This woman over here is making one of the best
made
arcade
one of the
games.
Made one of those popular arcade games there is.
Yeah, but they're not part of our target audience.
She's like, making it for boys to play.
Right. It's ridiculous.
Well, that is funny because that is one of the first games I played. My mom got me a Game Boy Pocket and that and Donkey Kong. I was like, yeah, I'll be good for a while.
Absolutely. And who knows how many women were involved in the development of games like Donkey Kong that really just did not get credited. But skipping forward a little bit, we didn't have a whole lot of companies that focused on making games for girls with any sort of intelligence behind it. Like, there was Rhiannon Games, but they were just kind of like, this is what we think girls want, but we have done zero research. In 1995, there was a company called Her Interactive, which was a kind of spinoff that eventually became its own company of American Laser Games. And this was one of the executives at American Laser Games, a woman, I forgot to write down her name, but she basically spun this whole other company off called Her Interactive. And their first game was a game called Mackenzie & Co., which was like a dating simulation game for Windows 3.1, Windows 95, and Mac OS. the reaction to this was, this was some of the first like big name games to be released, and the general consensus at the time was, we don't think there's a market for this. So many publishers didn't distribute the game because they were told there's just no market for this. Girls don't want games at the time. Despite
but there
this,
already there already was a board game called Mystery Date.
Yeah.
That girls were wild about for decades at that point. So you don't think they'd want to do that on the computer?
Electronic Mall Madness, ring any bells?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. We're like, we're so close, right? So 80,000 copies of this game were sold despite not being published by a lot of people for saying there's quote unquote no market. The game had issues. It was still pretty stereotypical even for the early mid 90s. So there's definitely some issues there, but you know, it kind of demonstrated to people that there is a market here. There is, there's a market that can be created if you do the right stuff, right? In 1995 in Japan, we also had something pretty big happen. A console called the Casio Loopy was released. And this is a video game console targeted specifically at young women. The Casio Loopy is extremely rare. Not a lot of them were actually made. And I don't think it actually did well at the time commercially for a number of reasons. But the console itself is pretty cool. It had a mouse accessory that you could get to use it like a computer. And the graphics were similar to like a Super Nintendo, essentially. It
Ooh,
also
I'm looking
had,
at it. It looks cool.
Yeah. It had a built-in sticker printer. You could design your own stickers in a lot of the games and print. I know, right? So there were only 11 games ever made for the Casio Loopy. There is Anime Land, which is a basic sticker designer. There's Dream Change Kokin Chano Fashion Party, which is basically the gameplay involves choosing appropriate outfits and backdrops to meet the requirements of different modeling assignments. There's Hari Hari Seal Paradise, which is a sticker making game specifically for like the sticker printer. There's Little Romance, which is a game where you are making panel by panel your own romance manga, and then you can print each of the panels out and stick them onto a piece of paper to make your own manga. Isn't that cool?
I'm looking at a picture of one, and someone has the stickers that have the little speech bubbles, which I'm assuming are the make your own manga thing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's
that is so fucking cool.
Like the sticker printer is like, that's brilliant. I'm surprised it didn't do as well as it did. But interestingly enough, there's a game here called Loopy Town no Oheya ga Hoshii, which translates roughly to I want a room in Loopy Town. And this is a game where you're given your very own room to decorate with furniture and other items. But in order to get the furniture, you must work a part-time job to earn money. Does that
Sims?
Sound familiar?
Sims?
Let me repeat that last one again. In order to get the furniture, you must work a part-time job to get money. Does that sound like Animal Crossing to you?
That also sounds like Animal Crossing, but if I'm thinking of the game that I played first that had that sort of formula, I'm autistic. I was deep into Sims.
That's fair. This game didn't have any like desire and like need mechanics in the way that Sims does.
Oh, I love that then, because I would fucking ignore my Sims and be like, I'm trying to recreate my own home in this game. Go to work, work for me, buy me furniture.
Exactly. It's not officially stated anywhere, but this game most likely was part of the inspiration for the Animal Crossing series, because this came out several years before the first whispers of Animal Crossing would even come to Japan.
I do love an Animal Crossing. If Animal Crossing and Pokemon, when the new games come out, I'm like, all right, I'll play this one until I've reached my conclusion in it. And then I'm not going to play it again. But that's, I have seasons of being a gamer. And it's usually
totally
those.
Fine. What's interesting is there is a person who was involved in the making of this game named Kenji Terada, who was a writer for the early Final Fantasy games.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he kind of like jumped over to work on these, which is really cool. There's a lot of that. A lot of really famous developers worked on girl games early on. There is a whole bunch of games. One other game for the Loopy that I want to mention is Wanwan Aiju Monogatari, which is translated to Woof Woof Love Story. It's a romance like game featuring dogs, which I think is really cute.
Sign me up.
Yeah, there's PC Collection, which is like a set of productivity tools similar to what you would find on a PC at the time, and it's compatible with the Casio Loopy mouse. Yeah, there's several different games. There's Lupitan, No Wonder Palette, a Kid Pix-esque game for making art and stickers, all kinds of stuff. There's also Magical Shop, which simulated the Purikura photo booth of the time, if you're familiar with those, where you do like the different poses and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And it had filters and all this stuff. And you could basically simulate that photo booth experience with your sticker printer, which I think was really cool. It kind of has a bit of a cult following now, and I highly recommend that anyone who's interested in learning more about it check out a website where I got a lot of my sources from called Famicom.org, which is basically kind of like Wikipedia for girl games. And it's a really cool website. I highly recommend you check it out. And if you played any of the games that are listed on the site or any other games, you can submit to them like your own experiences and they'll add them to the site. Just kind of cataloging, it's a museum of girl gaming, which I think is really cool. Moving forward in time a little bit, right? So we had Her Interactive. They had a lot of stereotypical issues still with their McKinsey & Co. game. The Cassiolupi comes out. At this point, Mattel had made several Barbie video games, but they had never really quite caught on until a game called Barbie Fashion Designer. What's interesting is if you look in the 1996 best-selling games list, the ninth is Barbie Fashion Designer. But if you then go and look at the top-rated games of 1996 by every other, you know, IGN, Game Informer, whatever, all of those, PC Gamer, anybody, you will not see Barbie Fashion Designer on the list. This is a game that is right next to Quake, Doom, Diablo, Civilization 2, Command and Conquer on the list. People don't talk about it. Like, it's ridiculous. This was a very, very good game. This was perhaps the first very good girl game, and it blew up in a really interesting way. It showed to people that if you make a game for girls and it's good, you can make money. There is a market here, right? There's a possibility for doing this. There just wasn't the knowledge at the time. And I think also there's a bit of a lack of desire on the, you know, mostly male marketing industry to figure out a way to get into that market, right? Market research at the time, once we hit a few years later, 1998, showed that most girls did not own consoles. So most of the games at the time were CD-ROM games. They were in very, very pink, sparkly purple packaging, and the quality was not very good. People didn't want to invest a lot of time and energy into a possible flop, and that resulted in just a kind of a stereotype of girl games are bad games because nobody wanted to invest. None of these big companies wanted to invest in a new girl-focused IP, basically. So
that makes a lot of sense because the games I had for my Nintendo 64 were not my horse games.
Oh, yeah.
Like, my absolutely. Horse games were all on the computer.
Yep, absolutely. And that's because the market research at the time very clearly showed that most girl gamers did not own a console. However, there were absolutely girl-oriented games of the time that did do quite well and were, like, good games. Or, well, sorry, they didn't do well, but they were good games. One in particular is a classic we all know and love, Bishoujo Senshi Seramon Supa Supa Fua Fua Penikuni.
Yes, of course, of course.
It's a Sailor Moon game based on, it's very similar to Panel de Pon, which is also what eventually would lead into Tetris Attack.
This for Sega?
I think it might have been for the Genesis, potentially. There was a very popular Genesis game of the time with a horse.
Not with a horse. I'm thinking of Sailor Moon specifically. So many, many moons ago, I got James a Sega emulator thing that through, you know, nothing I did, but means that seem probably extra legal, has a bunch, basically all of the games they possibly did. There was a Sailor Moon one on there that was like,
absolutely.
Oh, hell yeah, Sailor Moon. And on his Sega emulator thing, I have played a Sailor Moon game.
I don't know if that was the game, because there was a lot of Sailor Moon stuff at this point. Yeah. This is when Sailor Moon was blowing up. But that was one of the games that people say is quite good. There was a game for the Sega Genesis at the time that was aimed at girls in the U.S. called Crystal's Ponytail. And it's a game about I think it's like a platforming adventure, basically, where you play as a pony with a purple mane and a green tail. and you are just running around doing pony stuff, basically. And
incredible.
It, from what I understand, it's not a bad game by any means. It's not amazing, but it's a decent game. However, the reviewers of the time pretty much panned it for being, and I quote, too pink.
Okay, yeah. Great. Did you play it? Okay, sure. It's like someone playing Doom and going, too many demons.
Yeah, too many demons. Right. It's very silly. So you're probably realizing at this point, why don't they try making a game aimed at girls that doesn't have these stereotypes, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that kept me from playing a lot of them.
Exactly. So a lot of people at the time were starting to come to that conclusion. 1997, we get a company that pops up called Purple Moon Games. I don't know if that rings any bells to you, but the goal of Purple Moon Games was to make games for girls based on research into what girls actually wanted to play, not just assumptions and stereotypes. And the result of this was the really the kind of cult classic Rockets series of games and the Hidden Paths series of computer games. And both of these did quite well, but the research from these games and the development of these kind of showed that the results came back basically saying that young girls actually wanted topics like boys and ponies and gossip and complex social interactions and, you know, feelings of not being understood and like exploring all of those social dynamics and everyday situations. That is what younger girls want. However, the research that they did seemed to indicate at the time that as girls got older and became women, they lost interest in those topics, basically. It's what seemed to be showing based on their research. That research didn't really, like, the data didn't really line up with the goal, the morals that they wanted to do, which was to say, oh, let's make games that girls actually want. And it turns out, well, young girls do want those to a degree. They do want games about these topics. They just want them done well, right?
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, the research at the time that they did showed that young girl gamers did not care so much for quality as they did about the topic. And then as they got older, the reverse was true. They cared more about the quality of the game than the topic.
So interesting.
That's what the research at the time, that's what they took from the research at the time. That left very little room to consider making quality girl-specific games aimed at women over a certain age, or really making quality games for women at all. It really just didn't seem to make sense based on that research.
So however, you had me wondering, quick interruption, you had me wondering, I was like, oh yeah, there was one other quote-unquote girl game I played in the late 90s, and I was like, I wonder if it was from these people who wanted to make the quality girl games. And that was, I had a few Nancy Drew games.
Yeah.
But they were from Her Interactive.
Yeah, absolutely. Hers, I think they're still around, or they might still be around, but I think they've got bought by Mattel at some point.
So the one I found that I played was Nancy Drew Secrets Can Kill from 1998. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Nancy Drew games were, this was an era where people were starting to realize that there is a market here based off of the success of Barbie fashion designer. Because even if publicly people were not recognizing its influence and the quality of the game, the sales numbers were there and people recognized there's a market here.
Yeah,
exactly. The research seems to indicate that quality was not the factor that made Barbie fashion designer a success. And they couldn't quite figure out what was it. If it wasn't that. So there was some, from my perspective, it seems like they misunderstood the research, because obviously the answer is the topics are the topics, but the quality needs to be there for people to care about it, right? When smaller devs started, like development companies started to figure out around this time that girl gamers wanted just quality games, and they would play girly games if they were good. And this didn't really kind of come to fruition until the early 2000s. At this point, we start getting games like the Saddle Club games and the Nancy Drew games based off of the book series.
Fuck me up with the Saddle Club games.
Absolutely, yeah. The most popular of those was the Saddle Club. I forgot to write down the name of it, but there's one particular saddle game. It starts with a W. I think it's like Willowbrook Ranch or something like that. I did not put it in my notes for some reason, but there's one particular game, I think it's from like 2005, developed by IR Gurus Interactive, which I don't think is still around, published by Infogrames, and that was a pretty popular game at the time as well. So making games for girls at the time started to center around things that were popular in book and TV form and saying, let's make this into a game format that's accessible to girls. Starting around 2005, we had this boom of games also that were not marketed towards women, but were still extremely popular with women. And I'm looking at things like the Harvest Moon series, the Gaia Online game, if you're familiar with that. Gaia
Online, my very God, dress up focused. Yeah.
Yeah. The Sims, that whole game series it's basically a dollhouse, right?
I love Sims. And also, if you're autistic, mm-hmm. it is lining up your toys, essentially.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's why it's also popular with the autistic community.
And we still had some games coming out around this era that were genuinely good games, but they were still being panned for being girly, basically. One that comes to mind at this point is Style Savvy. And that's a whole series of games that was very quite good. It's a dress-up game. There's also the Nikki series, which you may know the most recent entry, Infinity Nikki. And that's actually a whole series going back to the early aughts, essentially, of like dress-up and kind of adventure games. And I'll definitely touch on that more here in a second. But if you notice, a lot of the girl-marketed games at this point are still falling into these same stereotypes. What I believe is happening here, there's a YouTuber called Moon Channel that did a video talking about girl games that I referenced some for this Info Dumpies, and they made a really good point that in a couple ways, that the passivity of the game design that we are making for women, we're making games where the activities are all very passive. There's very little competition. There's very little stakes outside of drama and things like that. They're all very passive, and that is a reflection of how society wants women to be.
Mm-hmm.
They are giving them passive games in the hopes that they will maintain passivity and that thinking that they want passivity when that's not really the case. And they also pointed out, Moon Channel, there's some comparison there to, if you recall, the speech that Mr. Rogers did when he was kind of fighting for PBS's funding, and he talked about how there's no need for violence on the show because the situations that Mr. Rogers presents on the show are, you know, simple family dynamics and thing, you know, situations that come up in day-to-day life that could, you know, for an average person be a stressful thing, like getting a haircut, right? That is still interesting, and we can do that. There are ways to make these topics interesting without adding competition and violence.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really smart take. And I think that is the key to making a game that is marketed to girls that is still good, is you have to respect that violence is not necessarily required. Like there is interest, and there is a whole world of experience here on the feminine side of things that is interesting. And there's so much dynamic to it that can be explored in the medium of games. And
not to be contrarian to that point too, though, but I wonder if there's ever been a game that, because to me, I don't often associate femininity with an aversion to violence, but I'm wondering, has anyone ever made one that you think the core of it is like feminine rage?
I have just the game, and I'm going to touch on that right at the end here in just a second. Yeah. One other thing, kind of a flip on that, there also, in the early aughts, we started getting games that were, in a general sense, marketed to women, but were also pretty popular in general. I'm thinking about the games like Nintendogs and Cooking Mama.
I loved Nintendogs. Yeah. You know, you didn't even have to ask.
Oh yeah. Now, hey, game developers out there, you heard that reaction, right? So think of this, Nintendogs plus horses. Just mix those two.
Fuck it up, yes.
Right? That's money. You would make so much money, right? Just look at what Red Dead Redemption did in terms of horse interactions. That level of graphics, make it good. That's money. But anyway, Cooking Mama was very influential. It showed a way of gaming in what is traditionally considered a feminine space in a way that treated it with respect. Like, this is something that is, it's not just like boring women's work. This is something that is interesting, and it's a challenge, and it's something that you can
take
practice
skill
and be good at. And it's skill, and it's valued. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about Cooking Mama, is that it valued what is stereotypically work that is assigned to women in a household, and assigned a lot of value and skill to it, which I appreciated for. But where are we now, right? We've got the Infinity Nikki games, or the Nikki series, with Infinity Nikki being the most recent release. We also have a lot of indie games that are really nailing the games aimed at girls. And we also have a lot of cozy games, which are often conflated with being girl games, like Stardew Valley and things like that. Cozy games and girl games are not the same thing. I think there's just a lot of accessibility in cozy games, and a lot more, it's just accessible as a genre, right? It's kind of the same reason that the slasher horror genre, that's not as big as the Marvel multiverse movies, right? And it's because of it accessibility, right? This is not everyone's major interest. And so,
and for me, cozy games I prefer because the world is stressful enough. I do not want to be, and especially as an autistic person, where I'm like, I'm constantly in a hurry. Everyone's constantly trying to make me hurry. I have to hurry and do things. I'm slower than everyone else. I have all of these things that have time limits. I have to like produce these responses. I have to think on my toes. My brain's fucking tired. So sometimes I just want to go like playing Unpacking, that game Unpacking, with you.
Absolutely. That was on my list here.
I was going to say, I'm so glad. That game's so fun. But calming, it still takes some effort and some skill. It's pretty to look at, and like my brain can relax.
Exactly. Yeah. And from a game design perspective, I think that comes down to a lot of differences in societal pressures that are put on men versus women. When it comes to men, oftentimes the societal expectation is be successful. You have to be successful. You have to be powerful and successful. And I think that is where a lot of the games like Doom and things come in. It is in a sense, a power fantasy rather than a comfort fantasy. Whereas, women are, I think, in my opinion, like it seems like I was not really like raised for the most part as if I were female. So I can't speak to that from experience, unfortunately. But it seems like the prioritization that women are told as they're growing up is you need to prioritize making sure everything is taken care of and safe and comfortable and clean. Yep. And this stability is the priority. And even if you can't get that in real life, whether it be power and success or stability, cleanliness, comfort, video games can provide that in a sense of accomplishment in that way.
There was always an expectation that you put others' needs above your own, even if it makes you uncomfortable, and to give of yourself. So games that let you be comfortable, and like Pokemon even does this for me, where I'm not under the gun for time. Like, it's not a big time thing. I can do it in my own way. I can organize. I like lining up toys. I could do a whole episode about games that are just lining up your toys and why autistic people like them. But games where I'm not put on all of this pressure. I can kind of just do my own thing, and nothing's going to jump out at me.
Yeah. You're vibing. You're having a good time. You're relaxing.
Vibing, keeping it tight.
Yeah. A lot of the games that people associate with, quote unquote, real games, right? And that whole can of worms, like we talk about Call of Duty and Elden Ring and things like that, right? These games center around trying to create for the player a feeling of overcoming a challenge and accomplishment. You know, people like myself that were raised under the expectation of being a man were like kind of trained for that reward feedback loop, that if we can feel like we've accomplished something in a game, that gives dopamine. And that's a big part of, at the end of the day, why I play games, because even if I feel like I fucking failed at everything I did today, I know I can beat this Elden Ring boss. And when I do, I'm a little bit closer to becoming Elden Lord. And that means I'm not bad at everything, right? I've accomplished something. I'm useful, right? And that's kind of where that the dopamine comes in there. And for me, I don't have as much of a desire to seek the comforting experience, though I still do. I absolutely love games like Unpacking, A Little to the Left.
The tiny Glade. You absolutely still like those games, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think just traditionally, I also get a lot of value out of the other type of game.
Well,
but
I think on the Elden Ring episode, you also brought up the point that trans women probably like the Dark Souls games quite a bit because, you're in a cruel and unforgiving world that specifically wants to kill you, but with some skill, you can overcome it. Like,
exactly. Overcoming. Absolutely.
I think you could do a whole episode about trans femme video games and why trans women are mostly attracted to those games.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of which, there's a whole genre of games out there nowadays that are integrating the traditional, you know, shoot 'em up and like traditional like action adventure male dominated genres and putting a girly spin on them. And I want to shout out a really cool game that's coming out soon called Don't Stop Girly Pop. And Yeah, it's like a high speed, fast, like arena shooter style game, kind of like Doom. But it is Y2K, Frutiger Arrow, high, like super high saturation, girly colors. You get your like missions from like a pink flip phone with like gems all over it.
Oh my God, can we please play this together?
Absolutely. Oh my God. It's in my Steam wishlist already. The moment that comes out, I'm playing it. And it's the whole, like, the premise of the game, Don't Stop Girly Pop, is that in order to not, like, get killed, you have to keep moving. There's also, they've integrated some fashion elements where, like, it's a first-person shooter, so you primarily see your character's arms. There's, like, a whole, like, fashion designer segment where you can, like, gussy up your arms in different patterns and
That's
jewels
so
and
cute.
Stuff. And I'm like, yes, this is what we need. This is the girl game. These are what we need. You know, and like Infinity Nikki gets into that a little bit where they're adding complexity outside the dress up. I could speak an entire episode on gacha games and why they piss me the fuck off. But Infinity Nikki also does a lot of things right because they've made a lot of very good, high quality decisions. The graphics are outstanding. A lot of the gameplay feels very good. There's a lot of open world platform elements that have been very well executed. There's crafting. So much is good there. And so we're finally seeing now that well-done games targeted towards women can absolutely do well. And I'm really excited to play Don't Stop Girly Pop. I'm really glad that we're kind of coming into a renaissance of girl gaming, I feel like. Finally getting some, like, AAA love for girl games, starting with, like, Infinity Nikki, right? Because this is a major company that makes this game. Don't Stop Girly Pop is more of an indie title, and there have always been amazing indie girl games. And I could do a whole other episode on indie girl games. I absolutely could and probably should. But yeah, people, individuals will always, I think, have a lot more foresight into what people actually want and making things that are much more heartfelt than corporations ever will.
Yeah.
So that's kind of just a rundown of girl games and where they came from and where we're at now. And I'm sure there's a lot of games out there that I didn't get a chance to talk about that some of you may be like screaming at your phone or whatever you're listening to to this with right now going, well, you didn't talk about this. What about this game? There's so many. There's a lot of girl games out there. And the sad part is a lot of them, unfortunately, have been kind of lost to time because the mainstream gaming industry does not put any effort into preserving them. There's a lot of effort to preserve games nowadays through emulation and things like that. And so many girl games are getting totally just left by the wayside. And that's why things like Femicom are so important.
Well, cool. Do you think you could help me find that Let's Ride game?
100%. I bet you there's some way we can play that game again.
It's cool. You could do stuff like barrel racing and shit. It was really fun.
Ooh. Is that where you do like Star Fox barrel rolls out in space?
Not even a little bit. If you're doing a barrel roll on a horse, something's gone horribly, horribly wrong. Hopital, please.
Unless.
No, Hopital.
No,
Hopital. Hopital immediately. Hey friends, if you like this episode, you can thank our Patreon supporters like Jill Shamba, Bethany Glass, Percy, Chamberlain Foreman, Nanya B, Kate Michigoose, K Genius, Chibs 1012, Dave Perrell, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus Lutzi, Helen Clifford, B Trossler, Sewing Seraph, Rachel Sin Fintago, and Randy Lovings. Now, you know the usual, if you want to help us out, you can tell other people about the show. We don't take paid ads, we don't pay for advertising, so you getting other nerds to listen to us is entirely how we grow. So if you think you know someone who would be into this episode, just send them the episode and say, listen to this now. Or not. I mean, send it to them, but you don't have to say, listen to this now. But yeah, we grow by word of mouth. That's entirely how today's lucky winner has grown. That's entirely how we have so many lovely Patreon supporters that help us make the show and work on other shows that we're working on. It is entirely because of y'all. So keep sharing the show. Tell people about it. That's the best way to help us. You can also subscribe on your podcatcher of choice and leave a cute rating and review and even a comment if you're on Spotify, because it lets you do that on episodes. That helps the algorithm know that people are interested in the show. It helps it know to show the show to people who like similar shows. And the engagement helps us with the algorithms, so you can help us that way as well. If you're in a place to help us financially, you can go to the show details and go to the link to the Mixnomer Patreon page. There you'll get rewards for all Mixnomer stuff. There are different tiers, but it starts at just $1, and you can help support this show, all of our shows, and help us make more weird shows. And if you want to come hang out with us, you can also check out the show details for a link to our Discord server. The Discord server is great. We have regular streams, regular events. The vibes are great. Genuinely, I'm so happy that our shows attract such really kind people, like legitimately, and the Discord server is lovely, and it's just great. You should join. It's really fun. But that is all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.